rising crime, these were the other big issues that year. It was a sleazy campaign by Nixon, one that is now regarded by political historians as a watershed, marking a sharp decline in the tone of our national discourse. In many ways, George W. Bush reminds me more of Nixon than of any other president. Like Bush, Nixon subordinated virtually every principle to his hunger for re-election. He instituted wage and price controls with as little regard for his conservative principles as President Bush has shown in piling up trillions of dollars of debt. After the oil embargo of 1973, Nixon secretly threatened a military invasion of the Middle Eastern oil fields. Now Bush has actually done it, keeping his true intention secret, as Nixon did. After he was driven from office in disgrace, he confided to one of his regular interlocutors, "People react to fear, not love. They don't teach that in Sunday school, but it's true." Speaking on national television that night before the 1970 election, Senator Ed Muskie of Maine addressed the real choice confronting the voters. "There are only two kinds of politics. They're not radical and reactionary, or conservative and liberal, or even democratic and Republican. There are only the politics of fear and the politics of trust. One says you are encircled by monstrous dangers. Give us power over your freedom so we may protect you. The other says the world is a baffling and hazardous place, but it can be shaped to the will of men. Cast your vote," he concluded, "for trust in the ancient traditions of this home for freedom." The next day, my father was defeated by the politics of fear. But his courage in standing for principle made me so proud and inspired me. I really felt that he had won something more important than an election. In his speech that night, he stood the old segregationist slogan on its head and defiantly promised, "The truth shall rise again." I wasn't the only person who heard that promise, nor was I the only one for whom that hope still rings loud and true. But before such a hope can be realized, we need to understand the implications of fear's new prominence in our democracy. In the following chapter, I will explore why, in an atmosphere of constant fear, the public is more likely to discard reason and turn to leaders who demonstrate dogmatic faith and ideological viewpoints. These new demagogues don't actually offer greater security from danger, but their simplistic and frequently vitriolic beliefs and statements can provide comfort to a fearful society. Unfortunately, the rise of these leaders serves only to exacerbate the decline of reason and further jeopardize our democracy. Chapter 2. Blinding the Faithful. The relationship between faith, reason, and fear sometimes resembles the children's game of rock, paper, scissors. Fear displaces reason. Reason challenges faith. Faith overcomes fear. In a book banned by the church during the decade of Galileo's trial in the 17th century, Religio Medici, Thomas Brown wrote, "As reason is a rebel to faith, so passion is a rebel to reason." Brown was one of many who struggled during the early Enlightenment with the conflicting claims of ultimate authority made by the church, the rule of reason, and human nature. He concluded that faith, reason, and passion may be all kings, and yet make but one monarchy, every one exercising his sovereignty and prerogative in a due time and place, according to the restraint and limit of circumstance. During the century and a half that followed, from Galileo's imprisonment to America's independence, many Enlightenment thinkers began to insist that reason alone must occupy the throne as the new sovereign source of authority. "Fix reason firmly in her seat and call to her tribunal every fact, every opinion," wrote Thomas Jefferson. "Question with boldness even the existence of a God, because if there be one, he must more approve of the homage of reason than that of blindfolded fear." Jefferson and our other founders believed that the progressive unfolding of the Enlightenment would allow reason to assume important duties that had been performed by blind faith. They had confidence that the twin daughters of reason, science and law, would enlighten us and empower us to restrain our passions and build our courage. They believed that in the process, the American people would find a new source of security from existential fear in a self-government based on the rule of reason. Though most of the American revolutionaries never adopted the extreme anti-clerical views of their French counterparts, they nevertheless felt keenly that organized religion in the Old World had been a cynical ally of the political despotism they aspired to overthrow. After all, many of them were descended from immigrants fleeing oppression and religious persecution. Jefferson wrote that throughout history, the state-sanctioned religious authority has been hostile to liberty. He is always in alliance with the despot, abetting his abuses in return for protection to his own. It is easier to acquire wealth and power by this combination than by deserving them. In his very last letter, written 10 days before his death, a few hours before that of John Adams, on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson expressed his hope that the Declaration would arouse people throughout the world to burst the chains under which monkish ignorance and superstition had persuaded them to bind themselves, and to assume the blessings and security of self-government. That form, which we have substituted, restores the free right to the unbounded exercise of reason and freedom of opinion. All eyes are opened or opening to the rights of man. The general spread of the light of science has already laid open to every view the palpable truth that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God. It is important to note that what Jefferson warned against was not faith itself, nor even organized religion itself. He was warning us against the combination of religious dogma and governmental power. He and our other founders fought just as hard for the free exercise of religion by individuals as they fought against the establishment of religion by government. It is also one of America's most painful ironies that Jefferson and many of our other founders often seemed so blind to the immorality of their own participation in slavery. How could Jefferson write with such force and clarity about the contemptuous idea that some people were born with saddles on their backs and not immediately free the slaves he owned? Another point. Many of those who began the abolitionist movement were more motivated by their religious beliefs than by reason. And the fact that faith led them more quickly to the truth about slavery calls into question Jefferson's easy conclusion that reason is superior to faith. Still, for most people, a balance between reason and faith is a better guide than either alone. With a few exceptions, our founders were not irreligious. They knew then, as most of us feel now, that despite the many clashes between reason and faith, these cohabit much more easily in the mind than do reason and fear. As John Donne wrote at the beginning of the 17th century, "Reason is our soul's left hand, faith her right." Fear, however, can disrupt the easy balance between reason and faith, especially irrational fear of a kind less readily dispelled by reason. When fear crowds out reason, many people feel a greater need for the comforting certainty of absolute faith, and they become more vulnerable to the appeals of secular leaders who profess absolute certainty in simplistic explanations portraying all problems as manifestations of the struggle between good and evil. It may well be that the global epidemic of fundamentalism, Muslim, Christian, Hindu, and Jewish, among others, has been partly caused by the dizzying pace of technologically driven change. This unprecedented globalizing tsunami has disrupted many age-old traditional patterns in families, communities, markets, environments, and cultures all around the world. To brace themselves and their families against disturbing and disorienting change, people instinctively reach for the strongest tree they can find, which is often the one that seems to have the deepest roots. As people cling ever more firmly to their religious traditions, they can become more vulnerable to ideas and influences that reason might filter out in less fearful times. If dogma and blind faith rush in to fill the vacuum left by reason's departure, they allow for the exercise of new forms of power more arbitrary and less derived from the consent of the governed. In simple terms, When fear and anxiety play a larger role in our society, logic and reason play a diminished role in our collective decision-making. Unfortunately, the new expressions of power that surface in such circumstances often spring from the deep poisoned wells of racism, ultra-nationalism, religious strife, tribalism, anti-Semitism, sexism, and homophobia, among others. And the passions thus mobilized are exploited most of all by those who claim divine authority to restore security and order. Throughout history, our innate fear of others who are different from us has combined all too frequently with some malignant dogma, masquerading as a message from God, to unleash the most horrific violence and oppression in the repertoire of hell. Moreover, this deadly form of exclusivist group passion can be virtually invulnerable to reason. So it is especially useful to demagogues who learn how to fan it and exploit it to gain and consolidate power. One of the most important contributions of America to the world was the precision of our founders in separating the relationship between God and government. God's role in establishing the basis for government, they believed, was to endow every individual with certain unalienable rights, not to endow any particular leader with divine right to exercise power over others. Having replaced the divine right of kings with the divine rights of individuals, our founders overthrew the monarchy and designed a self-government according to the strictures of reason. And they took special care to insulate the ongoing deliberations of democracy against the recombination of fear and dogma by guarding against any effort by government to establish in law any trace of divine justification for the exercise of power. They were also keenly aware of the thin and permeable boundary between religious fervor and power-seeking political agendas. "A religious sect may degenerate into a political faction," wrote James Madison, "but the new American nation would nevertheless be protected against the ungovernable combination of religious fervor and political power as long as the Constitution prohibited the federal government from establishing any particular creed as preeminent." This principle was so well established that in 1797 the U.S. Senate unanimously approved and President John Adams signed a treaty that contained the following declaration: "The United States is not a Christian nation any more than it is a Jewish or Mohammedan nation." In the absence of a national religion, the guarantee of freedom for individuals to believe what they wish would inevitably produce a panoply of different doctrines. The founders understood that the way to protect and defend people of faith, and I am one, is by preventing any one sect from dominating. Thus, Madison continued, even if a passionate religious sect became a political faction in one part of the nation, the variety of sects, dispersed over the entire face of it, must secure the national councils against any danger from that source. In other words, the separation of these sects would guarantee that their respective efforts to exercise power would cancel out one another. Our founders relied time and again on this same Newtonian system of checks and counterweights in order to protect the Republic against the abusive combination of religion and political power. They trusted in the mechanics of balance because they knew that human beings would always seek power. Therefore, the only way to create a safe forum for reason was to disperse power into separate sources that would constantly push against one another in a self-balancing system. And they followed one guiding principle above all others in their effort to establish an equipoise that allowed rational discourse to maintain its equilibrium: prevent the concentration of too much power in the hands of a single person or small group. Over 60 years ago, in the middle of World War II, Justice Robert Jackson wrote, "If there is any big star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion." His words are no less true today. Any effort by any government official in America to claim any divine right is therefore blasphemy. Government, in the American design, has absolutely no God-given rights. Its moral authority comes from the integrity of its deliberative processes and our own participation in those processes. Its derivation of just power from the consent of the governed must flow according to the rule of law. As John Adams first wrote in Massachusetts, we are a government of laws and not of men. The separation of church and state was thus based not only on the founders' insights into fear, faith, and reason, but also on their new awareness of the nature of power. They understood that the love of power can become so intoxicating that it overwhelms reason. It was actually this distrust of concentrated power that led them not only to separate organized religion from the exercise of governmental authority, but also to separate the powers of the national government into three co-equal branches and embed each in a complex web of checks and balances designed to further prevent the aggregation of too much power in any one branch. Laws were to be deliberated carefully and crafted within a legislative branch that was itself insulated against the danger of concentrated power with its own separation into two co-equal chambers, each endowed with a different set of perspectives and incentives, and with special provisions designed to protect passionately held minority views from being overrun by majority opinions. Each of these laws was to be administered by an executive whose power was also constrained and circumscribed by the Constitution. Then, as a further protection against the abusive use of governmental power, every law was also subjected to review by a Supreme Court whose members, once appointed and confirmed, served for life, and whose duty was to ensure that the principles embodied in the Constitution were not violated by any law, either in its wording or in its execution. But this intricate clockwork mechanism of American government has always depended on a ghost in the machine. The ghost animating the Constitution's machinery is not holy. It is us, all of us, the proverbial well-informed citizenry. We may be endowed with individual rights by our Creator, but we act to protect those rights and govern our nation with the instruments of reason. The immune system of American democracy has operated more effectively when citizens of the nation had a greater opportunity to examine every fact, every opinion, before reason's tribunal. Even though there has never been a time when the system worked perfectly, we have had greater success as a nation when there has been more open discussion of the options before us. But our continued willingness and competence as citizens to play that essential role has now been called into question. Our facility with rational analysis is not what it used to be. The truth is, reading and writing simply don't play as important a role in how we interact with the world as they used to. Our ability to operate the intricate machinery of self-government has always depended to an underappreciated degree on a widespread familiarity and competence with printed words. The Constitution, all of our founders' explanations of their intent, all of the laws passed by Congress, and all of the Supreme Court decisions of the last 218 years are in printed words. As citizens, if we are not well practiced in and thoroughly familiar with the use of words as handles with which to grasp our power as citizens, we have a diminished ability to fix reason firmly in her seat. The metaphor of our immune system, protecting our democratic system, has recently been enriched by new understandings about how our biological immune system operates. The brain and the immune system have something important in common. Neither is fully formed at birth. Both continue to develop rapidly during infancy. We humans have the longest extended period of infancy of any creatures in nature. This characteristic of our species, called neoteny, has profound implications for our tendency to absorb vast amounts of culture, tradition, and beliefs into the operating system of our brains. Psychological and relationship patterns, including dysfunctions, and all manner of other habits and behaviors are passed down from one generation to the next. The immune system calibrates itself during infancy and childhood as it produces antibodies in response to threats to health. When the antibodies are no longer needed, the genetic codes necessary for reproducing them are stored by the immune system so that they are readily accessible in case there must be an immediate surge in the production of these antibodies to repel subsequent threats. In much the same way, traumatic memories remain preferentially accessible, stored in the fear center of the brain. Scientists have recently discovered that the modern practice of quickly treating infants with massive doses of antibiotics at the first sign of a threatening pathogen has had a disturbing side effect. It deprives the immune system of its ability to learn how it should respond quickly and appropriately to pathogens. As a result, the normal close-order drill of a healthy immune system can become freewheeling, loose, and inexact in its responses to threats, and can become confused into responding inappropriately to benign insults as if they were deadly threats. The increased incidence of asthma and other immune system disorders may be more attributable to this disabling of the immune system than to the new prevalence of pathogens in the environment. It may well be that the disuse of democracy's calisthenics, the sharp decline in reading and writing, and the bombardment of every new fear with television commercials and simplistic nostrums disguised as solutions for the indicated fear, has given American democracy an immune system disorder that prevents the citizenry from responding precisely, appropriately, and effectively to serious threats to the health of our democracy. So all of a sudden, we overreact to illusory threats and underreact to real threats. The disclosure that our government had been cruelly and routinely torturing captured prisoners and was continuing to do so as official policy provoked surprisingly little public outcry, even though it threatened America's values and moral authority in the world. Similarly, the disclosure that the executive branch had been conducting mass eavesdropping on American citizens without respecting the constitutional requirement that it obtain judicial warrants and was continuing to do so caused so little controversy that the Congress actually adopted legislation approving and affirming the practice. Yet this action threatened the integrity of the Bill of Rights, which is at the heart of America's gift to human history. At the same time, the majority of citizens were led to wholeheartedly approve and endorse the invasion of a country that did not attack us and posed no threat to us. And there was little opposition expressed to the redeployment of U.S. troops and other war-fighting resources from the hot pursuit of the terrorists who actually did attack us and who actually do pose an ongoing threat. So how could we have become so confused about the difference between real threats and illusory threats? Are we now exhibiting the kind of freewheeling and loose response to dangers facing the Republic that make us less capable of maintaining the healthy operation of American constitutional government? And even if you disagree with my conclusions about the choices the administration made, wouldn't we be better off if we had a full and open debate about them? By portraying the invasion of Iraq as the central front in an epic struggle between good and evil, President Bush sought to cloak his policy of unprovoked war in the garb of religious faith. America had been momentarily stunned, of course, by the ferocity and magnitude of the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001. The fear of further attacks and the intense anger we all felt at those who killed our fellow citizens made our country unusually willing to follow the leadership of our president and strike back at targets of his choosing. Initially, he wisely sent troops into Afghanistan to attack the terrorists and disrupt their bases. But soon thereafter, Bush began to redirect the nation's desire for revenge away from Osama bin Laden and towards Saddam Hussein. He offered Americans a way to cut through the complexities of foreign policy by sorting every nation in the world into two simple categories. You're either with us or against us. He described Iraq as part of the axis of evil and offered forged evidence that Hussein was seeking to develop atomic bombs. Ironically, the other two members of that axis, Iran and North Korea, have used the last 6 years to actually pursue nuclear weapons programs. Well before he began beating the drums for war against Iraq, Bush had already announced that his chosen enemy was evil itself. The day after 9/11, Bush announced, "This will be a monumental struggle of good versus evil, but good will prevail." 2 days later, I was sitting in the audience at the National Cathedral when Bush proclaimed that his responsibility to history was to rid the world of evil. I actually thought that most of the president's speech that day was excellent, and I told him so. But I remember being astonished at the grandiosity and hubris of his odd and disturbing claim that he could and would rid the world of evil. Really? The following week, in addressing a joint session of Congress, Bush said God had foreordained the outcome of the conflict in which we were engaged because freedom and fear, justice and cruelty have always been at war, and we know that God is not neutral between them. As others have noted, Bush's view of his policies in the context of a fateful spiritual conflict between good and evil does not really represent Christian doctrine. It actually more closely resembles an ancient Christian heresy called Manichaeism, rejected by Christianity more than 1,000 years ago, that sought to divide all of reality into two simple categories, absolute good and absolute evil. Simplicity is always more appealing than complexity, and faith is always more comforting than doubt. Both religious faith and uncomplicated explanations of the world are even more highly valued at a time of great fear. Moreover, during times of great uncertainty and public anxiety, any leader who combines simplistic policies with claims of divine guidance is more likely to escape difficult questions based on glaring logical flaws in his arguments. There are many people in both political parties who worry that there is something deeply troubling about President Bush's relationship to reason, his disdain for facts, and his incuriosity about any new information that might produce a deeper understanding of the problems and policies that he is supposed to wrestle with on behalf of the country. Yet Bush's incuriosity and seeming immunity to doubt is sometimes interpreted by people who see and hear him on television as evidence of the strength of his conviction, even though it is this very inflexibility, this willful refusal even to entertain alternative opinions or conflicting evidence, that poses the most serious danger to our country. By the same token, the simplicity of many of Bush's pronouncements is often misinterpreted as evidence that he has penetrated to the core of a complex issue, when in fact exactly the opposite is true. They often mark his refusal even to consider complexity, and that's particularly troubling in a world where the challenges America faces are often quite complex and require rigorous, sustained, disciplined analysis. Yet I don't remember a single newspaper, commentator, or political leader ever questioning the president's claim that our nation's objective should be to rid the world of evil. Further, I heard precious little questioning of the preposterous logic by which the president and vice president had conflated Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. It was as if the nation had decided to suspend the normal rigors of logical analysis while we pursued war against a noun, terror, and a nation, Iraq, that had absolutely nothing to do with the attack we were seeking to avenge. After invoking the language and symbols of religion to bypass reason and convince the country to go to war, Bush found it increasingly necessary to disdain and dispute inconvenient facts that began to surface in public discussions. He sometimes seemed to wage war against reason itself in his effort to deny obvious truths that were totally inconsistent with the false impressions the nation had been given prior to making the decision to invade. He and his team seemed to approach every question of fact as a partisan fight to the finish. Those who questioned the faulty assumptions on which the war was based were attacked as unpatriotic. Those who pointed to the forged evidence and glaring inconsistencies were accused of supporting terrorism. One of Bush's congressional allies, John Boehner, then House Majority Leader, said, "If you want to let the terrorists win in Iraq, just vote for the Democrats." This same pattern has characterized the effort to silence dissenting views within the executive branch, to censor information that may be inconsistent with its stated ideological goals, and to demand conformity from all executive branch employees. Those inside the administration who sounded alarms about the increasingly troubling signs that our nation was marching with blind faith into a strategic quagmire were intimidated, threatened, and censored. For example, the administration undercut the four-star general who was chief of staff of the U.S. Army, General Eric Shinseki, by naming his successor 14 months before his retirement. And Major General John Batiste testified last year that anyone in the Pentagon who asked about post-war planning was threatened with being fired. Astonishingly, the bipartisan Iraq Study Group felt it was necessary to include in its report last year a recommendation that the White House restore the tradition of candor in the relationship between civilian leaders and the uniformed military and allow generals and admirals to tell the truth and give honest recommendations without fear of retribution. I use the word astonishing because I remember when American citizens, in their role as voters, would have so severely punished such outrageous abuses, especially in time of war, that it would have been inconceivable that a bipartisan panel of experts would need to advise the president to allow his generals to tell the truth. The framers of the Constitution understood the threat posed to rational debate by the use of intimidation to silence truth-tellers. As Alexander Hamilton put it in Federalist No. 73, a power over a man's support is a power over his will. As another example of this phenomenon, before the Iraq War began, CIA analysts, who strongly disagreed with the White House assertion that Osama bin Laden was linked to Saddam Hussein, found themselves under pressure at work and became fearful of losing promotions and salary increases. And tragically, the CIA failed to correct a manifestly false view that there was a linkage between al-Qaeda and the government of Iraq. That is similar to what happened in the 1960s to FBI officials who disagreed with J. Edgar Hoover's view that Dr. Martin Luther King was closely connected to communists. The head of the FBI's Domestic Intelligence Division said that as a result of his efforts to tell the truth about King's innocence, he and his colleagues became isolated and pressured. It was evident that we had to change our ways, or we would all be out on the street. The men and I discussed how to get out of trouble. To be in trouble with Mr. Hoover was a serious matter. These men were trying to buy homes, mortgages on homes, children in school. They lived in fear of getting transferred, losing money on their homes, as they usually did. So they wanted another memorandum written to get us out of the trouble that we were in. Soon, there was no more difference of opinion within the FBI, and the false accusation became the unanimous view. The very idea of self-government depends on open and honest debate as the preferred method for pursuing the truth, and a shared respect for the rule of reason as the best way to establish the truth. The Bush administration routinely shows disrespect for that whole basic process. It claims divine guidance. It feels it already knows the truth and isn't very curious to learn about any facts that might contradict it. For example, Bush described the war in Iraq as a crusade, disregarding the obvious fact that the sectarian implications of that description might make the task for our troops more difficult in a Muslim nation that had repeatedly fought off invasions by Christian crusaders in the Middle Ages. One of the generals in charge of war policy, William G. Boykin, went on a speaking tour of conservative evangelical groups in his spare time to declare, from the pulpit, in uniform, that our nation was in a holy war as a Christian nation battling Satan. Boykin may have felt safe in using the language of the Crusades, even though the United States was desperately seeking Muslim allies at the time, because his commander-in-chief had repeatedly used religious language and symbols in his presentation of his policy, and Bush was far from the only fundamentalist politician taking this approach. As recently as Christmas 2006, Congressman Robin Hayes, Republican, North Carolina, proposed that the only enduring solution for the multi-sided sectarian civil war in Iraq was spreading the message of Jesus Christ. Everything depends on everyone learning about the birth of the Savior. Well, Congressman, I consider Jesus to be my savior also, but Iraq is a Muslim country. General Boykin was never removed from his job. This was the same General Boykin, by the way, who helped organize the use of abusive treatment of prisoners in Iraq. And given the origins of the new policy approving torture, it is not surprising that the abuse was directed not only at the prisoners' bodies, but also at their religious beliefs. Many prisoners testified that guards forced them, under pain of torture, to curse their religion, eat pork, and drink alcohol in violation of the rules of their faith. One of them told a newspaper reporter that he was first ordered to denounce Islam, and then, after his leg was broken, one of his torturers started hitting it and ordered me to thank Jesus that I am alive. These examples are so horrifying in part because they are so contrary to what America is all about. What makes the United States special in the history of nations is our commitment to the rule of law and our devotion to democracy and the rights of individuals. Because the founders were insightful students of human nature, they knew that there is good and evil in every person. They feared the abuse of power precisely because they understood that each of us lives every day with an internal system of checks and balances, and none of us can be relied on to be virtuous if we are allowed to attain an unhealthy degree of power over our fellow citizens. Consider the balancing of internal impulses described by one of the soldiers at Abu Ghraib convicted of abusing prisoners, Specialist Charles A. Grainer, Jr. Grainer was confronted by his colleague, Specialist Joseph M. Darby, who would become a courageous whistleblower. When Darby asked Grainer to explain the actions captured in the photographs Darby discovered on the photo disc, Grainer replied, "The Christian in me says it's wrong, but the corrections officer says I love to make a grown man piss on himself." What happened at that prison, it is now clear, was not the result of random acts by a few bad apples. It was the natural consequence of the Bush administration policy that dismantled the constraints of law and the Geneva Conventions, made war on America's system of checks and balances, and evaded accountability and responsibility for the actions it ordered. The abuse of the prisoners at Abu Ghraib flowed directly from the abuse of the truth that characterized the administration's march to war and the abuse of the trust that was placed in President Bush by the American people in the aftermath of September 11th. When you boil down precisely what went wrong with the Bush-Iraq policy, it's fairly simple. He waged the politics of blind faith. He used a counterfeit combination of misdirected vengeance and misguided dogma to dominate the national discussion, bypass reason, silence dissent, and intimidate those who questioned his logic both inside and outside the administration. He adopted an ideologically driven view of Iraq that was tragically at odds with reality. Everything that has gone wrong since has been in one way or another the result of the spectacular clash between the bundle of misconceptions that were gullibly consumed before the war and the all-too-painful reality that our troops and contractors and diplomats and taxpayers have encountered since it began. When that painful reality began to displace illusion in the public's mind, the president made increasingly strenuous efforts to silence the messengers of truth and create his own version of reality. His seeming contempt for the rule of reason and his early successes in persuading people to believe in his dogma-driven view of the world apparently tempted him to the hubristic and deeply dangerous illusion that reality itself has become a commodity that can be created and sold with clever propaganda and public relations skills. Did he himself believe what he was telling the country? It is hard to know. In the words of British author and journalist George Orwell, "We are all capable of believing things which we know to be untrue, and then, when we are finally proved wrong, impudently twisting the facts so as to show that we were right." Intellectually, it is possible to carry on this process for an indefinite time. The only check on it is that sooner or later, a false belief bumps up against solid reality, usually on a battlefield. there have been other collisions between President Bush's created reality and America's actual reality. The president's distortion and rejection of the best available evidence on climate change mirrors his modus operandi in misrepresenting and suppressing the best evidence available on the threat posed by Iraq. And his budget policy, which transformed a $5 trillion surplus into a $4 trillion deficit, has been, in its own way, just as spectacular a collision between illusion and reality as the Iraq War. Again, it was the result of completely rejecting the best available evidence on the threat posed to America's economy by his tax and spending proposals. Some mistakenly malign the president as not being smart enough to have normal curiosity about separating fact from myth. Others seem convinced that his personal religious conversion experience was so profound that he relies on religious faith in place of logical analysis. But I reject both of those cartoon images. I know President Bush is plenty smart, and I have no doubt that his religious belief is both genuine and an important motivation for many things that he does in life, as my faith is for me, and as it is for most people. I'm convinced, however, that most of the president's frequent departures from fact-based analysis have much more to do with his right-wing political and economic ideology than with the Bible. I've alluded to James Madison's warning over 2 centuries old that a religious sect may degenerate into a political faction. Now, with the radical right, we have a political faction disguised as a religious sect, and the President of the United States is heading it. The obvious irony is that Bush uses a religious blind faith to hide what is actually an extremist political philosophy with a disdain for social justice that is anything but pious by the standards of any respected faith tradition I know. The truth about this particular brand of faith-based politics is that President Bush has stolen the symbolism and body language of religion and used it to disguise the most radical effort in American history to take what belongs to the American people and give as much of it as possible to the already wealthy and privileged. And these wealthy and privileged individuals look at his agenda, and they say, as Vice President Dick Cheney said to former Secretary of the Treasury Paul O'Neill about massive tax cuts that they both knew would create an enormous budget deficit, "This is our due." Make no mistake, it is the president's reactionary ideology, not his religious faith, that is the source of his troubling inflexibility. Whatever his religious views, President Bush has such an absolute certainty in the validity of his rigid right-wing ideology that he does not feel the same desire that many of us would in gathering facts relevant to the questions at hand. As a result, he ignores the warnings of his own experts, forbids dissent, and often refuses to test his assumptions against the best available evidence. He is, in fact, out of touch with reality, and his recklessness risks the safety and security of the American people. The Bush administration has demonstrated contempt for the basic tenets of a rational decision-making process, defined as one in which an honest emphasis is placed on getting good facts and then letting good facts drive decisions. Instead, the hallmark of the current administration is a systematic effort to manipulate facts in service to a totalistic ideology that is felt to be more important than the mandates of basic honesty. More than 300 years ago, John Locke, one of the architects of the English Enlightenment that was so influential in shaping the philosophy of our founders, wrote, "Every sect, as far as reason will help them, make use of it gladly, and where it fails them, they cry out, 'It is a matter of faith and above reason.'" Thus, it is crucially important to be precise in describing exactly what belief system it is that Bush accepts so uncritically and insulates from any logical challenge or even debate. The surprising recent dominance of American politics by right-wing politicians whose core beliefs are usually wildly at odds with the opinions of the majority of Americans is one that resulted from the careful building of a coalition of interest groups that have little in common with one another besides a desire for power that can be devoted to the achievement of a narrow agenda. This coalition of supporters includes both right-wing religious extremists and exceptionally greedy economic special interests, both groups seeking more and more power for their own separate purposes. All have agreed to support one another's agendas, even when it is ideologically inconsistent to do so. The only consistent loser in these exchanges is the American citizen. As a whole, this coalition reveals exactly what our founders warned against, that a faction might come to dominate politics and pursue power for its own sake. In case after case, the president has pursued policies chosen in advance of the facts, policies designed to benefit friends and supporters. These supporters have, in turn, benefited the president with enormous contributions and political muscle. This self-reinforcing cycle of mutual backscratching has pushed government policy further and further away from the public interest. So it should not be surprising when the president uses tactics that deprive the American people of any opportunity to effectively subject his arguments to the kind of informed scrutiny that is essential to our system of checks and balances. The first important group in this coalition is what I would call the economic royalists, who are primarily interested in eliminating as much of their own taxation as possible and removing all inconvenient regulatory obstacles. Their ideology, which they and Bush believe with almost religious fervor, is based on several key elements. First, there is no such thing as the public interest. That phrase represents a dangerous fiction created as an excuse to impose unfair burdens on the wealthy and powerful. Second, laws and regulations are also bad, except when they can be used on behalf of this group, which turns out to be often. It follows, therefore, that whenever laws must be enforced and regulations administered, it is important to assign those responsibilities to individuals who can be depended upon not to fall prey to the hated illusion that there is such a thing as the public interest, but who will instead reliably serve the narrow and specific interests of this small group. Some of these activities will be discussed further in Chapter 3. What members of this coalition seem to spend much of their time and energy worrying about is the impact of government policy on the behavior of poor people. They are deeply concerned, for example, that government programs to provide health care, housing, social insurance, and other financial support will adversely affect work incentives. They are also opposed to the minimum wage, the 40-hour work week, job safety laws, consumer protection, the right to sue an HMO, even as they seek the authority to intervene in American families' medical decisions, the right to privacy, and the right to clean air and water. In short, if they were to achieve their ambition, they would eliminate an economic blueprint that created most of the safeguards and protections established for middle-class families throughout the 20th century. This group has provided the bulk of the resources that have financed the now extensive network of foundations, think tanks, political action committees, media companies, and front groups capable of simulating grassroots activism and mounting a sustained assault on any reasoning process that threatens their economic goals. Many of the problems President Bush has caused for this country stem from the marriage of these resources to his belief in the infallibility of this right-wing Republican ideology that often puts the highest priority on the interests of the wealthy and of large corporations. The second branch of this coalition is made up of the foreign policy hawks, whose policy preferences range from unprovoked invasions to economic imperialism. Their overarching goal is to maximize U.S. influence around the world. Treaties and agreements are considered antithetical to orthodoxy because they can interfere with the exercise of power the same way domestic laws can. The Geneva Conventions and the U.S. law prohibiting torture were both described by President Bush's former White House counsel as quaint, and then effectively discarded as a constraint, so that Bush and former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld could institute policies that resulted in the widespread torture of detainees in Iraq, Afghanistan, Guantanamo, and numerous secret locations elsewhere. And even though Pentagon officials confirmed that Rumsfeld was personally involved in reviewing the specific extreme measures authorized to be used by interrogators at Guantanamo, procedures that served as the basis for those used in Iraq, he was not held accountable for the most shameful and humiliating violation of American principles in recent memory. The way in which President Bush tries to create his own reality reminds me of when Richard Nixon once told the interviewer David Frost, "If the president, for example, approves something, approves an action because of national security, or, in this case, because of a threat to internal peace and order of significant order, then the president's decision in this instance is one that enables those who carry it out to carry it out without violating the law." This is exactly the rationale offered by the White House to support its position that Bush's inherent power as commander-in-chief makes everything he does legal by definition. Torture, according to this twisted logic, is just fine as long as the president orders it. Or as Nixon famously put it, when the president does it, that means it's not illegal. This may be more than a facile comparison between two failed presidents. Bush's two most influential advisors, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, both worked very closely with President Nixon when he was in the Oval Office. From all reports, Cheney and Rumsfeld were the most enthusiastic advocates of the Iraq invasion and the decision to suspend the prohibitions against torture in the Geneva Conventions. It is no secret that both men looked at the rollback of unexamined presidential authority after Watergate with abhorrence. The progressive abandonment of concern for reason or evidence has required the administration to develop a highly effective propaganda machine with which it attempts to embed in the public mind mythologies that grow out of one central doctrine upon which all the special interests agree. Government is very bad and should be done away with as much as possible, except the parts of it that redirect money through big contracts to industries that have won their way into the inner circle. This coalition gains access to the public through a cabal of pundits, commentators, and reporters. Call it the Limbaugh-Hannity-Drudge axis. This fifth column in the Fourth Estate is made up of propagandists pretending to be journalists. Through multiple overlapping outlets covering radio, television, and the internet, they relentlessly force-feed the American people right-wing talking points and ultra-conservative dogma disguised as news and infotainment 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. It is quite a spectacle. What is most troubling to me is the promotion of hatred as entertainment. Moreover, they have actively conspired to fan the flames of a vicious hatred aimed at one group in particular, Americans with progressive political views. They speak of liberals with the kind of dripping contempt and virulent hostility that used to be associated with racism and sectarian religious strife. One of the best-known right-wing commentators, Ann Coulter, advised her audience that she was in favor of executing an American citizen who had joined the Taliban in order to physically intimidate liberals by making them realize that they could be killed too. One of the coalition's constitutional scholars, Edwin Vieira, echoed Coulter's hateful rant at a conference on the so-called judicial war on faith by explaining how he would recommend handling the Supreme Court. He actually quoted Joseph Stalin, saying that Stalin had a slogan, and it worked pretty well for him whenever he ran into difficulty: no man, no problem. The only way to explain an American constitutional scholar endorsing ad hominem attacks on Supreme Court justices is to assume that he has abandoned reason and surrendered to dogma. Moreover, by quoting Stalin, a homicidal dictator whose only peers are Mao and Hitler, he had to realize that he was implying that he might even agree with a vague threat of physical violence against justices whose opinions violated right-wing orthodoxy. Former House Republican leader Tom DeLay also implied that violence against judges was appropriate. "Judges need to be intimidated," he said. "We're going to go after them in a big way." The tragic episode involving Terri Schiavo, the brain-dead woman who captured the nation's attention in 2005, provoked his most ominous threat to the bench. After judges ruled in favor of her husband's decision to remove her feeding tube, DeLay said, The time will come for the men responsible for this to pay for their behavior. Of course, the Schiavo affair revealed something larger about the Bush coalition's zeal. It proved that they are willing to shoot themselves in the foot to defend the purity of their sect's dogma. That's what happened when religious conservatives pressured the president and Senate Majority Leader to call a special session of Congress to pass a bill that would force reinsertion of a feeding tube to artificially keep a woman in a vegetative state alive. Bush and former Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist agreed, playing politics with the Schiavo family's private tragedy. The overwhelming majority of Americans in both political parties told the president and the majority in Congress that they strongly disagreed with this extremist approach. The episode's blowback demonstrated the limits of the coalition's radical strategy. In extreme cases, it turns out, the public finds the dangerous mixture of religion and politics repugnant. Most people of faith I know in both parties have been getting a bellyful of this push by extremists to cloak their political agenda and religiosity, mix it up in their unholy blend of religion and politics, and then force it on everyone else. The emergence of an ultra-conservative, anti-government dogma that increasingly relies on the encouragement of mass hostility toward non-believers is an extremely troubling new development in America's public forum. As we've seen, it turns James Madison's prophecy on its head. A political faction has degenerated into a quasi-religious sect. It is a sect that sounds as if it believes America is in the early stages of an ideological civil war. It promotes its core beliefs as if they are impervious to reason, and it is unleashing and encouraging ugly and violent impulses. This right-wing sect often manifests a complete lack of empathy toward other Americans whom it identifies as its ideological enemies. This curious trait can make the mouthpieces of the radical right appear to be coldly insensitive. For example, when several widows of victims killed in the 9/11 attacks expressed impatience with the Bush administration's unwillingness to cooperate with investigators trying to find out why the warnings were ignored, the widows were immediately attacked and vilified by a chorus of right-wing commentators who all seemed to be reading from the same tone-deaf script. To take another example, one of the radio hosts in this group, Neil Bortz, was whipping up public anger at the victims of Hurricane Katrina when they expressed impatience with the Bush administration's incompetent rescue and relief efforts. In the course of his diatribe, he commented on a news story about one Katrina victim who had received no support after losing everything. Bortz criticized her for not having a job and then recommended that she turn to prostitution. "If that's the only way she can take care of herself," he said, "it sure beats the hell out of sucking off the taxpayers." Comprising the final pillar of this coalition are extreme religious conservatives and fundamentalists, many of whom want to roll back most of the progressive social changes of the 20th century, including many women's rights, social integration, the social safety net, and the government social programs of the progressive era, the New Deal, and the Great Society. While the economic royalists provide the financial support for this new coalition, a group of ultra-conservative religious leaders, who actually are primarily politicians, provide manpower and voter turnout. They serve a special purpose with their constant efforts to cloak the right-wing faction's political agenda in religious camouflage. Many of them also have their own media outlets and are part of the propagandist wing of the coalition. Of course, many of these ministers are genuinely and deeply concerned about the wave of disorienting change that has contributed to the rise of fundamentalism all over the world, and some of them, to their credit, are now emerging as thoughtful critics of distinctly unchristian elements of the right-wing agenda. But others are just cynical, garden-variety political hacks dressed in clerical collars. Jerry Falwell, for example, seized upon the nation's tragedy only 2 days after 9/11 as an opportunity to inspire more hatred of Americans with progressive views, identifying them, as usual, as enemies of Christianity. "I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians," he began, "the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who have tried to secularize America, I point the finger in their face and say, you helped this terrorist attack to happen. In the same way, James Dobson, the leader of Focus on the Family, demonstrated just how quickly a religious minister could morph into a political attack dog. During the 2004 election, at a political rally in support of a Republican candidate for Senate, he argued that only Republicans would stand up for Christian values. He said of a prominent Democratic senator, Patrick Leahy, I don't know if he hates God, but he hates God's people. I think it's important to expose the fundamental flaw in the basic arguments of these zealots. The unifying theme now being pushed by this coalition is actually an American heresy, a highly developed political philosophy that is fundamentally at odds with the founding principles of the United States of America. Once again, here is what they have backward. In America, we believe that God endowed individuals with unalienable rights. We do not believe that God has endowed George Bush or any political leader with a divine right to exercise power. In fact, here in America, we believe it is blasphemy to assert that the creator of the universe has chosen to endorse a particular political party. The historic temptation for religious zealots to subordinate the rule of law to their ideological fervor is perhaps captured best in words given by the author of the play A Man for All Seasons to its hero, Sir Thomas More. When More's zealous son-in-law proposes that he will cut down any law in England that serves as an obstacle to his hot pursuit of the devil, More replies, "And when the last law was down, and the devil turned round on you, where would you hide, Roper? The laws all being flat. This country's planted thick with laws from coast to coast, man's laws, not God's. And if you cut them down, and you're just the man to do it, do you really think you could stand upright in the winds that would blow then?" A great many laws and constitutional principles have been cut down in recent years. To take another example, those desiring to weaken the separation of church and state have tried to undermine the independence of the judiciary and stack the courts with politically responsive judges who do not share the traditional American wariness of establishing religious dogma in law. Toward this end, these zealots have sought to deprive the U.S. Senate of its rule requiring a supermajority to end debate on the confirmation of judges. The zeal with which they have attacked the rule of law reminds me of Sir Thomas More's son-in-law. The Senate's rule has stood for more than two centuries as a protection for unlimited debate. I will discuss the importance of the filibuster as a democratic tool in Chapter 8, but worth considering here is how it prevents those in power from governing by faith alone. The filibuster has been used for devilish purposes on occasion in American history, but far more frequently it has been used